Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob. Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We'd like you to look at the discussion questions before we start tonight, for they are going to be the kind of thing that you need to keep in mind during the whole lesson tonight. So look at the discussion questions before we begin, please. Important questions that lead us into purpose and the heart of what God's going to try to say to us tonight through the preacher Coley, professor. Tonight I'm going to read my translation. I'd like you to follow me as I read verses 1 through 11. This chapter breaks into two parts very easily. And you follow me in your translation, please. I said to myself, "Come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself." And behold, it was futility. I said of laughter, "It is madness," and of pleasure, "What does it accomplish?" And I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is in the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself in which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves. I had home-born slaves. I possessed herds and flocks larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself gold and treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. And my wisdom also stood by me. And all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all the activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity, striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. Notice, if you will, please, what this guy is going to do. Now, he's going to test some things and see if they hold water. The things he's going to test is pleasure and wisdom again. And I think by pleasure, we need to understand that it's not just... We usually tend to think of pleasure as, things that involve the five senses. But this guy is enlarging that definition to include pride and what he's accomplished, his stature in life, his fame, and that kind. He's talking about everything that might make someone happy, pleasure. And he's going to talk about that and what it means. Now, notice it says that I will test you with pleasure. I think sometimes we as Baptists are very bad about getting down on ourselves about some of our bodily stimulation. And by that I mean we feel guilty about doing things that we enjoy. Have you forgotten who made the human body and who put the desires for the human man and the human woman in there? We sometimes get so wrapped up that things seem wrong to us. God has made us in such a way that it seems like that we yearn toward stimulation of the five senses. We crave after more and more. And that is not necessarily bad if we're guided by God's kind of guidelines. For you see, the desires that we have, in many instances, are there because God made us that way. Now, I understand there's been a fall, and that creation has been affected by that. But I also know that man has been made in the image of God, and that image was not obliterated. It was marred. It was scratched. It has been defaced. But it's still there. And I think we need to recognize again and again that some of the things we have are gifts from God. Two of them that Baptists are very nervous about is two he's going to talk about: sex and wine. Have you ever thought that sex is a gift from God that was given before sin ever entered the world? We're very nervous about wine. My word, we just get all goosebumpy. The Old Testament says that wine is a gift from God that gladdens the heart. So let's look at what the preachers are going to say about these two kind of things and many others. First, notice what he says in verse 3. He's going to stimulate his body with wine. Now, what does he mean by that? Is he advocating drunkenness, revelry? Is he saying, I'm just going to drink so much that I lose my perspective in life, you know, and just I'm going to drown my troubles in the booze, so to speak, you know, going to cry in my beer with the boys? You know, is that what he's talking about? Well, the reason I don't think so is the second little phrase doesn't make sense to a drunk person, and that is, my mind was guiding me wisely. Now, what's he saying? What he's saying is, I'm going to try the stimulation of alcohol and see if it works. Everybody talks about how great it is. In our day and time, probably a more contemporary thing would be, what does pot really taste like anyway? Does it really set you free? Does LSD really make you more creative? You know, the drugs really set you free from your bodily limitations? That's the kind of crud we hear all the time, isn't it? I can't cope with life, so I take heroin. Well, Coley says, I've heard about these kind of things, but I'm just going to try it out and see. I'm going to drink and see if it really sets me free. See if all that it's cracked up to be is true. And he found something very peculiar about pleasure. Touch pleasure, taste pleasure, eye pleasure. The only time you enjoy it is when you're doing it. And the problem is you've got to keep on doing it over and over and over and over, and you're never satisfied. Put it this way. If you could do anything you wanted to, whenever you wanted to do it, I'll give you 2 years and you'd be bored to death with life. So if you can do what you want to do, you get bored. And if you can't do what you want, you get frustrated. Now, have you ever thought of the real paradox of men? The world, and especially I love TV commercials. Golly, they are the devil's weapon if I ever saw it. I must have brushed my teeth when I was a kid 500 times a day with Ultra Bright, looking for that beautiful blonde that I always saw come out of that tube, you know. Brill cream. Had to use Brill cream because you knew that you'd be happy in a 1955 Ford, you know. If you had Ultra Bright, a new Ford, and a brick home, and a water purifier, golly, the world's the limit, you know. What couldn't you do? We've been sold down the river on stimulation of the physical senses. We have been sold a bag of goods. Isn't it funny that the people who can afford to do anything they want to do normally enjoy the simple life? Isn't it funny that when we reach for something we know will make us happy, it goes right through our fingers? You see, human pleasure is a very fleeting thing without God. Even something like drink, it may make you happy for a while, but the problem is, you wake up, and even the smell of stuff gets you yuck. And then, to have more fun, you've got to have some more the next night. And that's the problem with human pleasure, I think, that Coley's found. It's a vicious circle. It's self-feeding. There's no end to it. And when you think you've found it, you really haven't found anything that lasts. Now, I think it's a good place for me to talk about my understanding of the Bible in relation to alcohol. I hope you'll leave the hymnals in the rack. You will not throw your pen nor pencils at me. Back in the 20s, conservative Bible-believing Christians were persuaded by the more liberal element to back what is commonly called prohibition. They were told that look at the effects that alcohol has on our community. Look at the fact that it has mafia connections. Look at the fact that it breaks homes, it causes wrecks, people die. It's just bad stuff, and let's just get away with it. And the conservative Bible Christians begin to say, well, I realize that it really is it's a serpent. It can bite you. It can take your home. It can take your life. It can take your manhood or your womanhood. It can destroy you. But the Bible doesn't say that it's all bad. They said, look at the results. And so from about 1920s, all Christians have kind of got together, at least the conservative brand, and said, don't even touch the nasty stuff. Now, that's called legalism. Because behind that kind of thought is the thought that alcohol is evil in and of itself. Alcohol is no more evil in and of itself than heroin is evil in and of itself, that sex is evil in and of itself, that anything else in God's creation is evil in and of itself. I've used it before with you, I'll use it again probably. For a man on the battlefield, a shot of heroin is a gift of God. For a man in a ghetto who's trapped psychologically and physically, heroin is a tool of the devil. There were days when alcohol, for a man who's worked 18 hours a day in a coal mine, was the only way that man could go to sleep and relax. There are even people today who doctors put on small amounts of alcohol for tranquilizers. Now, I know it's been abused, but every gift that God has given to man, man has abused and perverted. I'm saying to you, the Bible does not teach total abstinence. The reason that I come back to total abstinence in my own personal life is the Bible rails against drunkenness. It said if you look on the wine when it's red, you're a fool. If you run to new wine, you're a fool. You're going to lose all you have. It rails against drunkenness, but it doesn't talk about total abstinence. I come back to total abstinence because I am a free, liberated child of God. And I come back to total abstinence as my gift to God of my freedom that others may not reject my message because of anything that I might do. Do you hear me? Please hear me. Why don't I drink? Because your church had kicked you out. No, my church is not my ultimate priority. My Lord is my ultimate priority. And Baptist tradition is next to my understanding of the biblical text. So why am I a total abstainer? And why don't I tell you you have to be like me? I simply say to you, Romans 14 is formative in my understanding of what Bob Utley does. Too many people are looking at my life that I would allow anything that I do or say to turn any seeking person away from Christ. So I limit my life with more rules than you could ever put on me in your wildest imagination. I limit my own life. But I limit my freedom out of my personal love for Jesus Christ. Therefore, I don't make rules for you. I say to you, the Bible does not teach total abstinence. I say to you that out of your freedom, you have to pray for what God's will for your life is. Notice he says, next, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is in for. I don't know what he means by folly unless it means something like, have you ever taken somebody and thrown them in the mud? That's kind of dumb, really, isn't it? I mean, just, you know, some of the dumb things we do as kids, just we do them dumb, but we just wanted to do it, you know? At camp, we squirt shaving cream on everybody, and it's a real blast, but that's just kind of dumb when you think about it. That's kind of what he's talking about, something that's not evil, but something that just really isn't too smart. I remember one time I was playing around, and I put some of this aftershave lotion under my arm, you know. God, I was playing around, and that about ate my lunch. I couldn't believe how bad that hurt. And I was just playing around dumb, you know. Well, don't you do that kind of thing? He said, I'm going to try even things that aren't logical. It's just dumb things. I'm going to say, is anything to this? Just act mad, maybe. Now, not evil, but just dumb, out of the ordinary. He said, there's nothing there. Notice that he comes down and says, I'm going to, look what else he's going to do. By the way, the word sons of men, to do under heaven, again in verse 3. This again goes back to my basic thesis of what Coleith is doing, is looking at human life apart from God and showing you the vanity and the folly and the ridiculousness of the way we live if there is no God. So now that's my presupposition all through the book. Coleith is tongue-in-cheek critiquing human society with the view of showing human society that in and of herself she is bankrupt and void of meaning. Okay, now, Boy, he built big houses, and he built big vineyards, and he built parks, and he built ponds, and he bought slaves and all that. What for? You say, he was doing it because he was a great humanitarian. No. He was doing it to solidify his kingdom politically. No. He says what he's doing for. It's about six times. For myself, for myself, for myself, for myself. What he's saying is, I did it all for me. This is part of my experiment. I wanted to do everything that anybody ever told me was fun. I wanted to do it. And he did the body and the mind and the ego and all the rest. He tried. He did. And that's why Solomon fits so well here. Because who else had more money and more wisdom and more chance to do this than Solomon? Now, notice where he says in verse 7, I bought male and female slaves. I had homebound slaves. One of the pitiful things of this to me is this man was one of the wise men of his day. He came with inspiration to speak about issues of life and the futility of man without God. But this man was blinded to an area, and that area was slavery. And we're not talking about different races. We're talking about Hebrews that sold themselves to other Hebrews to live. And that other Hebrew had total control over their life, except for the year of Jubilee, every 50 years, when a slave is supposed to be let go. But to our knowledge, Israel never observed one year of Jubilee. Now, I want to tell you that there are areas in our life today that we're blind to spiritually. Don't ever think that you've arrived, my friend. The day you think you've arrived spiritually, the day I can tell you with all authority, you've just begun. We grope as if in a dark tunnel sometimes for the will of God. We have to admit that we don't have all the answers, that our box will not hold God, that there's more to the understanding of life and God and God's will than we can ever come to. And by simple, humble faith, we just say, Lord, you lead me where you want me to go, and I'll walk as best I can. Friends, this guy had a blind spot. I want to bet you that 101% of us here tonight have blind spots spiritually, that we've cut areas of our life off from the Spirit of God. You say, not me, surely. You just showed one blind spot. Notice, if you would, please, he got herds and flocks larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Verse 7. This, to me, is another clue that what we have here is a guy who's, even though he's playing Solomon, put in the background of Solomon, he's admitting he's not, by the way he uses this, all who preceded me in Jerusalem, because the only person that it can apply to is David or the Jebusite kings or possibly Melchizedek, and it could go either way. Now, notice, if you would, please, in verse 8, I confess myself gold and silver and the treasures of kings and of provinces. This word for province is the word satrap. Persian word. There's several Persian words in here. I provided for myself male and female singers. This was a great source of pleasure. Remember how David came and soothed Saul when Saul had his fits of temper, and David would play on the harp and soothe him? Now, these aren't temple singers because women weren't allowed to sing in the temple. This is like a quartet for a local banquet or something. You know, he had a lot of men and women that must have lined his banquet halls that sang for the parties. And music was a very luxurious, exquisite form of pleasure to these people because most folks just never heard much. Now, notice what it says, the pleasures of men. Now, I'm on verse 8, so everybody turn your Bibles to Ecclesiastes 2:8 for sure. If you haven't had it open, open it now. Rick, what translation do you have, Wesley? Would you read the last part after the pleasures of men for me, the very last couple of words of verse 8? Right, very last part, just last few words. Ha ha! Men of musical instruments and that of drawn swords? Sorts, S-O-R-T. Okay, all musical instruments and that of all sorts. Who has Living Bible, please? Anybody? Read real loud from the last few words, Living Bible. Many beautiful concubines. You know what a concubine is, don't you? Whew. That's what mine has, concubines. That was unofficial, official wives. Who has a Revised Standard Version? Okay. Why don't I read it real loud for me? Many concubines, man's delight. Who has any of the translation here, please? Yes. Oh, good. Read good news for me. See how Solomon would fit real well in there? Now, again, almost every English translation has made this concubines. Now, I want to promise you that's not the Hebrew. The Hebrew is nothing like it. Even King James is not the Hebrew, but I'm letting King James off because they didn't have as many manuscripts as we have today. Every translation that you just read was written late enough that they ought to have known better to translate these words. They translate these words because they've always been translated this way before. Sound familiar? Now, the last part of this thing is a very unusual two Hebrew words. In the Talmud, these two words are defined in a very special way in a little book called Gittin, which is part of the Talmud. It's a tractate. And this is what the Jewish scribes say of this Hebrew word themselves. Originally, it meant ornamental pools and baths. CF Song of Songs. Pools and baths. Now, why is that people didn't buy that translation? The pleasure of men is ornamental baths? I mean, you guys like ornamental baths. Well, that blows that theory, doesn't it? I like bubbles, but the bathtub doesn't make any difference at all. Now, notice the next one is, in Babylon, these two words meant male and female concubines. No, demons. Male and female demons? The pleasure of men is male and female demons? In Palestine, this word is translated, these two were translated, the pleasure of men is carriages. Not carrots, carriages. Guess what? We don't know what this word means. Can you see why we don't understand what they mean? Now, because of the little phrase, pleasures of men, every modern translation has put concubines. This is not the Hebrew word for concubines. There's every Hebrew authority would say it's the majority of Hebrew authorities that I've read say male and female demons. Underline that and put, we don't know. Yes. Yeah, Septuagint. Right, Septuagint instead of the Vulgate. But where they got it from, I have no idea. Hebrew roots are very, very, they're just hard to pin down. You see, Hebrew only has consonants. And therefore, two consonants are a Hebrew root. And just think, if all you have is a combination of two letters for words, you can't make a whole lot of words with two letters, can you? You've got to vocalize them different to show the variety of meaning. So, and we've lost the vocalization of Hebrew. If we had the vocalization of Hebrew, we'd know exactly what these words mean. But they're gone. And all we have is the consonants. So it could mean this, or this, or this, or this, or this. Put a little note there, please, underline concubines, and say, very, very speculative. Okay. Now, beginning at verse 10. Okay? And all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold from my heart any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for my labor. Now, what's he saying? He's saying, a little while ago he said that labor's no good. Your work doesn't last. Nobody remembers you. You can't do nothing new. And now he's saying labor's good. Well, you've got to look at the context. The context determines. He said that work by itself is no good, but now he's saying, hey, you know, this experiment in pleasure wasn't half bad. I had a good time. You know, I just stimulated the hound out of my body and everything I could think about doing, and it wasn't half bad, but in the end, it was futility and vanity. Remember, I translated vanity of vanities as the word transitory? So what he's saying is human pleasures, well, I'll put it this way, there's pleasure in sin for a season. But seasons come and go, and pleasure is very passing, transitory, fleeting. You can't get a grip on it, you see. That's what he's saying. So he's saying, I had a ball doing this, but I realized it wasn't worth a whole lot. Now, verse 11, he considered all his activities and all that he had done, and he sums it up, says, vanity, striving after the wind, and there is no profit under the sun. Now, verse 12 down through 17. So I turn to consider wisdom, madness and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light exceeds darkness, and the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. And I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. What's he saying? The other chapter, he talks about the fact that wisdom in itself will not give ultimate value, because wisdom can only define reality. It can't change reality. Wisdom is very good at categorizing problems, but not good at solving problems. So now he comes to say, I'm going to consider wisdom again. Because you see, the scribes and the wise men of his day were saying, I'm going to show you God. You want to know God? Come to me. I'm a wise man, and I'm going to tell you how it really is. The same problem we had in the New Testament called Gnostics. It's the I've got a secret club. If you want to be really on the in group, if you really want to know God, you go to my seminary and read the books I read, and boy, you're going to be right in there. Now, but he's saying that wisdom is not as bad as being dumb. You might as well be smart as dumb. You might as well have a college degree as no college degree. It's a little better living if you have some kind of intelligence. But as far as ultimate reality, wisdom is not what'll cut it. So he's saying it's good, it's fine within limits. But as far as raising it to the ultimate in man's life, as far as giving meaning, ultimate meaning and joy, wisdom can't do it. The more you know, the more you know you don't know. The more you know, the more you want to know. So, notice what he says. Wisdom exceeds folly as light exceeds darkness. There's value in wisdom, but not ultimate value. For you see, back over in Proverbs 8, these scribes were getting very, very close to making wisdom equal to God. Did you see that? In Proverbs chapter 8, wisdom is the first creation of God, his first love. Wisdom created the world. Proverbs 8 is getting dangerously close to personifying wisdom and identifying wisdom and God. Now, you know the New Testament, the thing almost happened, and I hear it a lot today. And that is that God equals love, and love equals God. It's the same thing this guy is against. He's saying wisdom equals God, and God equals wisdom. Now, Colet is going to say wisdom is not the same thing as God. And I think I, as a New Testament understanding, will say love is not God. God is characterized by the quality of love. But it's a proposition that goes one way. God is wise, but wisdom is not God. Same with love. Now, all I hear today is God is love. He wouldn't dare get us. God's business is to forgive. Oh, he'll forgive. He just wants to love everybody, and he'll overlook that. Friends, I will tell you the flip side of God's love is I'm coming back in judgment. Everybody's going to stand before me. So to make God as love the supreme thing in the New Testament is simply not to read the Bible. Sounds real good philosophically, it just isn't very good biblically. Now, notice what he says here. See in verse 12 where it says, the man. Now, what in the world that means, we don't know. It's probably the king or my predecessor or mankind. It's the same kind of phrase as saying, the only reason you think something is new is because you have forgotten what everybody did before. It's the same kind of phrase as saying that. He's saying the reason that you think that you're going to do something new is because you have faulty history about what's already been done. Now, if you will, please, notice what it talks about in verse 14. And this is the ultimate leveling of mankind. I want to tell you, the rich, the poor, everybody, the dumb, the stupid, the wise man, the fool, they all going to what? Going to die. going to die. Not me, surely. You're going to die. It's one of the great questions of Christian faith is, can you handle it? Are you ready for it? It's coming. Not me, surely. It's coming. It's coming. You know, I enjoy doing funerals. Because for once in some people's lives, I'm going to have them at a crisis of life where they're going to think about the ultimate. Friends, you don't worry about the brand new contract and the brand new car and the new shoes and the house payment when you're about to die. It just doesn't seem to be real important then. And you begin to think about ultimate reality. The book of Ecclesiastes is saying, stop! Quit your living! Stop your rat race! Look what is really ultimate! What's going to last? What is real? Quit playing the game. Stop and look. This doesn't really matter. That's what he's saying. So he's saying the fool's going to die and the wise man's going to die. You're going to die. Now, what about it? Well, he just says, man, it's vanity. Because everything I do is going to be gone when I die. Notice now here in verse 16. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as there is not with the fool. Now, I will make a presupposition with you. If there is no God, there's no reason to be moral. If there is no God, there's no reason to live in love for mankind. If there is no God, all that those of us who claim to be Christians have sacrificed for is not worth anything. Less than that, it's really ridiculous. If there is no God, life is a tragic joke. But I submit to you, there is a God. Psalm 112:6. Proverbs 10:7 say something like this. The righteous deeds of the righteous man will not be forgotten. Codeth is saying, if there is no God, there ain't going to be nothing left of you in 50 years after you die to be remembered. Nothing. Now, you say, well, George Washington's got a statue. Great, we'll give you a statue. That's a great deal, a marble statue. You know, even marble don't last forever. Here's what he says. I hated, the word hated is not good in verse 17. It should be, I just was disgusted with life and the work that I had done under the sun. And it was, really the word there is, it was evil to me because everything is futility and striving after the wind. I want you to turn to Colossians chapter 3 with me real quick. Colossians chapter 3. I'm preached on one of these just like this Sunday. Colossians 3:24-25. Life is meaningless. Death is coming. We can't stop it. We're helpless in its path. It makes everybody equal. There's nothing to life. There's nothing. Knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, it is the Lord Christ whom you serve. For he who does wrong will receive the consequences of the wrong which he has done, and that without partiality. There is another life. It does make a difference how you live. The things you do for God will last. The things you do for yourself will not last. I don't know what you think you're taking with you. They asked the guy, what did Howard Hughes leave? He left everything. He left everything. What is ultimate? I think Coleth would say, knowing God. Serving Him, loving Him, living a happy life in the light of His love and understanding is going to last. But nothing else is. I've often wondered if God takes notes on my sermons, you think? Quote, no. 10 years from now, they'll say, what sermons? Just to touch our lives right now. It's not going to last. Now, notice if you will, please. In verse 18, by the way, I think 24, 25, and 26 sum up very well. So I'm not going to sum up every couple of paragraphs about the ultimate. But we'll get to it before we get through tonight. I need about 10 more minutes. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, and I must leave it to a man who will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool. This guy is just hit, he's just hit Old Testament theology head on. Old Testament theology says what? We're not sure about the afterlife. We think we're going to exist in Sheol, but it's going to be shadowy. We're going to live on in our children. Let's have male children. Let's have a big family. Let's keep our seed going. And Coley says, your children might be stupid. said, you might have really dumb kids that don't really appreciate what they got. Just don't care nothing about what you did. And history says that out, that usually kids react to their parents, and the values their parents had, their kids pull away from, and then it swings back. Vice versa. So, Solomon says, I don't want no brat to live off to me because he's probably going to be dumb. And that just kicks Old Testament theology right in the head. They kept saying, the more kids you got, the better. Coley said, not necessarily so. Because you know what our big problem today? Me included. You know why countries don't last more than a couple of hundred years? Because the terrible sacrifice of the people who died and sweated to make this country what it was, we haven't paid the price for that. And we take it so lightly. And we take it as if it were a natural right to be free. And we take it as if, well, it's just my natural right as a citizen of the United States to have these things. What we don't work for, we don't appreciate. That's why Solomon's son, and I'm using Solomon, that's what the writer's going to use, he said, even though he gets all these riches and all these glory and all these titles, he's not going to appreciate it because he didn't work for it. Now, there's exceptions because Solomon was an exception. But the general rule is, I made up my mind, and I hadn't told Peggy this, but when, you know, I have always wanted preachers to give me their library, you know, how I used to love to get books. But I found in my life, the books that people gave me are the books that are still sitting on my shelf that I haven't read. And the books that cost me something to buy are the books that I've already studied. And therefore, I'm not going to give my library to somebody. I'm going to give it to a school. So even though somebody would say, boy, look at this great library, they wouldn't appreciate it and they wouldn't use it. All of us are like that. What we get without cost, we don't appreciate. So he says, I can't do this. I'm not going to do it. So he's just kicking Old Testament theology right in the head. Verse 21. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, skill, and he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with him. That's it. Notice verse 22. But what does it get a man in all his labor? Now we're talking about under the sun in a human perspective. And this is what, and this striving with which he labors under the sun. What does he get? Well, number one, he gets all his days, his task is painful and grievous. And even at night, his mind does not rest. What do you get for being chairman of the board? Well, ulcers. What do you get for having the biggest Southern Baptist church? You get ulcers. What do you get for being noted and famous? Everybody know your name. You get loss of privacy. What do you get if you have all the money in the world? Bored. What do you get if you have all the sex you want? Tired and bored. I'm telling you, the things we put value in, there's no value there. Isn't it amazing? You know, I heard this in the paper today. It's executives in these big corporations, real big ones, are retiring below the minimum age barrier because these corporations couldn't understand why. These guys are the chairman of the boards and the big dudes, you know, in society. They're the ones that move the wheels. Two generations ago, the guys who became those would kill themselves working for that company. They'd just work and work 100 hours a week working for that company. And the guys today say, I'll make all the money I want at 30 and I'm quitting. Isn't it amazing that we think that if we work at a job all our lives, that when we get 60 years old, we're going to retire and enjoy it? And then we have a heart attack at 61. We go on strike for retirement benefits, and statistics show us that when a man quits the job he's doing and changes lifestyle that late, he doesn't last. What does our work get us? If you're not working for the Lord, I'm not saying preaching, I'm saying whatever you're doing, if it's not for the Lord, it's not going to do nothing. And if you get to the top, what have you got? You just walked on people. And when you get there, there's no joy. If God is somewhere not in the equation. Verse 23, I put a note down here. Even at night, his mind does not rest. I don't have all the things that I really want physically. And I'm not exactly where I thought I wanted to be when I was a young man. But I want to tell you what, folks. When I put my head on the pillow at night, boy, I sleep good. And I can remember when I used to wake up and be so terribly afraid to die, and so terribly afraid of failing, and so terribly afraid of letting people know that I wasn't all that I was cracked up to be, and so terribly afraid I'd make a mistake or go crazy or get shot or get hit by a plane or something. I want to tell you, I sleep good now. Verse 24 to 26 is a very important two or three verses in this book. For it is going to say the same thing as the conclusion of the book. Solomon couldn't wait. he got to think, maybe these guys think I'm really serious about what I'm saying. So he puts this in. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This is also, I have seen, that is from the hand of God. Now, what's this saying? Some people say, this is Epicurean theology. This is saying, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may croak. Not at all what it's saying. Not at all what it's saying. The words eat and drink are simply a way in Hebrew of describing the common, simple pleasures of life. What Solomon is saying, I think, Freudian again, when you look at life, if you look at everything through the eyes of is it going to last, nothing is going to last that we do, humanly speaking. Therefore, how do you sum it up? Just become a pessimist and sit around and drool all day and be mad and kick the wall and do graffiti on churches? What do you do? He would say, enjoy what God has given you. You've got a good wife, thank God, live happy. If you've got a good job, work, be content. If you can help people, fine. Be content. Enjoy the simple pleasures of life. That's what he's saying. And he says, you know why you can enjoy the simple pleasures of life, even though they're not of ultimate reality? It's because the simple pleasures of life are a gift from God. Solomon has just radically altered the equation. The equation has been man plus time equals zilch. Now what he's added to the equation is man plus God equals happiness. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? You catch the total change? It's like night and day. God is in the equation now, and the product has been altered radically. The same elements are in the equation. The elements haven't been changed. It's the conclusion that's been changed. For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. He couldn't quite get out of pessimism. Anyway, this is what he says. For to the person who is good, who's good? Jesus said, don't call anybody good. Jesus said, don't call me good. Call God good. So what does this mean, the word good? It's good in the relationship that a good person in Hebrew understanding would be someone who is not a habitual sinner, someone who attempts to keep the commands of God. And then the word sinner down there is one who is a habitual sinner. Anybody want to stand up who thinks they're good and not a sinner? We're not talking about absolutes, we're talking about relatives, someone who is not habitually given to their own desire but seeks after the will of God. So, he says, God has given him wisdom and knowledge and joy. It's just 5 verses above there. He says, wisdom is for the birds. There's happiness in nothing. I've tried all the pleasure, and there's nothing there. And then he says, but God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. So what's the difference? The thing is not the difference. God in the equation is the difference. Taking God into account in what we do is the difference. Not what we do. We always think that there's greener grass over there. If we only could be in that pasture, if we only could eat that clover, if we only had that home, that wife, that car, that job, that faith, that church, I'd be happy. Solomon says, without God, you're not happy, and with God, you're content where you are. Then he says, the sinner is going to gather for the other. I've got some passages on that, please. These aren't listed for you. Write down Proverbs 13:22. I think Proverbs 28:8. Job 27:16-17. The guy who thinks he's collecting it all to give to his kids or posterity or enjoy it himself, the Bible says the sinner is collecting for the righteous. You know why? Because creation belongs to us who know God. Isn't that something? This too is vanity and striving after the wind. From a human point of view, nothing fulfills. But you add God, and suddenly there's meaning in life. I have this last little thing. All Kohelet can say is enjoy God's gift today. That's all he can say. Kohelet says, even with God in the formula, enjoy God's gift today. Jesus Christ comes and says, enjoy God forever. And you can come live with me, and I'll make you one of mine. And we'll walk right on when time has long since forgotten what time's all about. Coley says, enjoy God today. Jesus asked that to say you can enjoy God forever if you come to know Him by faith.